This is Paul Carter with the Pioneer Agronomy Sciences, and we're here for our second Pioneer Agronomy Sciences seminar, and we're glad to have a group here, both online and in the room. First of all, we want to ask to check our audio. Is somebody online? Could you send a note and indicate yes, if you can hear me? Okay. That would be great. Okay. We got affirmation there. So. We'll get going. I'd like to introduce our speakers. We've had a nice collaboration with Dr. Newell Kitchen and his team over the past several years and on several projects, and they're going to focus on one of these that dealt with the with nitrogen management today. And Newell is a soil scientist with USDA ARS and adjunct professor at the University of Missouri. And his research is focused on integrated agricultural systems related to precision agriculture, soil and water quality, and nutrient management for improved fertilizer use efficiency. Newell has worked on anything that relates to cropping systems, really. He's been eager to jump into it. He was president of the American Society of Agronomy in 2011 and served that organization very well. And he's got a couple of students here today that are going to help him. Curtis Ransom did his PhD with Newell. He's a postdoc at the University of Missouri, working on some of the data we'll talk about for improving crop models to better optimize nitrogen fertilizer applications in the Midwest. And then Mac Bean is a graduate student also with Newell, and he's working on his PhD in soil science with some of the same data set on nitrogen. So. We're thrilled to have Newell here and his group. As far as we'll have time for questions at the end. We'll ask for questions of those in the room. And if you have questions on the webinar, be sure to send those in as well. Lance Gibson is helping me here. And we'll get those questions to Newell and his group as well. So with that, Newell, I'll turn it over to you. And we're eager to have you here to talk about this nitrogen project that we've had going the last few years. Newell, take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. And I would like to start off by saying, offering an expression of appreciation to Pioneer for the opportunity that we have had. And I think I'm safe in extending that appreciation, not just from myself and those of Missouri, but the full team. And you'll see a photo or a slide here in a few minutes that kind of represents that whole team. There has been nothing but a positive outcome relative to not just the contributions of science, but the positive networking that has come and the shared ideas and so forth out of this project. And very, very little downside to this. I come up with this title, Tackling the Core Nitrogen Recommendation Quandary, in part because I'm looking forward to the football season starting, collegiate football, and so tackling in there. But the quandary is what I want to focus on here and help us first start off the presentation. Not that none of us perhaps really has any kind of a timid understanding of what that difficulty is, but I want to kind of start off with that. And this is a slide that many of you have perhaps seen. It's a representation of the data or the representation of nitrogen uptake in corn. It comes out of that how our corn plant developed. That was published by the Iowa State University folks, and it's been updated at least once or twice over the years. And this representation is a good place to start, but as a part of this start, it's also to recognize that this is kind of an ideal representation. And in fact, as we look at that and we think about how much total nitrogen is taken up by the crop in a growing season and the dynamics of that uptake over the growing season, we do on many years get to where we're in the 250 to 300 pounds of nitrogen that the crop needs when things are really working pretty well. But lots of times, this is where agronomy comes in and compounds things, because on the same field in another year, it may be the crop only needs 210 pounds. Another year, you only need 180 pounds. Another year, you may only need 150 pounds. So same field, same crop, maybe same hybrid, but we're coming up with a dynamic that is difficult to predict at the, you know, before a season starts. What adds to that dynamic is to try to understand how much is actually going to come from the soil. We have a lot of soils here in the Midwest that have a lot of organic matter, others that don't have very much. But those that have a lot of organic matter, if you get the right conditions, you can get different amounts of soil nitrogen out of the soil. Oftentimes, so now what I have represented here is the fertilizer nitrogen uptake. And so this line represents how much is coming from fertilizer, whereas the difference between the top and here is maybe how much you're getting from the soil. And so part of the quandary that we have with this is in some years, it's 30 to 50 pounds. Other years, maybe 60 to 80 pounds you're going to get from the soil. In other years, it's 90 to 150 pounds of N from the soil. Things are really, the engine of mineralization is really revved up well. And so this is part of the quandary. Another part of the quandary is the spatial variability. And I'm sure Brent here in the room recognizes this field. This is probably a field that you've been on. This is in near Marshall, Missouri. And this field is a field we did a whole bunch of nitrogen rate plots across the field. You can kind of see there, the image is not real great, but there's a lot of different little blocks, checker blocks on there. And we were trying to get an understanding of what the site-specific economic optimal end rate was across this field. And over on this side of the field, we needed 180 pounds of nitrogen per acre to get the economic optimal end rate. And over on this side of the field, it was 40 pounds. So another part of the quandary we have is that there can be, with many fields, spatial variability of need that's expressed. And how do you address that? And in fact, from this field and a number of other fields that Dr. Peter Scarf, myself, Ken Setup did, we summarized all those. And within field, corn nitrogen fertilizer needs from numerous Missouri fields demonstrated that on average, the range an economic optimal end rate within a field was 88 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And about 32% of the fields that we looked at, it was greater than 100 pounds. Now, I will say, I think Missouri has more fields that have greater spatial variability than maybe other areas in the Corn Belt, but spatial variability is there on many fields in the Corn Belt. And so, not having methods and tools that help us to go after this means that we're not really going at solving the problem. And the problem is, how do we get to an understanding of how we come up with recommendations for these different fields and these different conditions? So we have the crop nitrogen need, and we have these different nitrogen rates, and then much of the Midwest is this, and that is, here we are either at planting or before planting, even the fall before, and we're making a decision. Is it that year or is it that year? Is it that year? And we're making the decision then, or again, before then, of how much to put on. And that's kind of the culture of what much of the Corn Belt is at still. And it's probably a little naive to think that you can do a very good job at trying to get to these if you're doing it way back here. If we go to a side dress application, you can kind of see at that point in time, there's maybe a little bit of a signature difference between those kind of curves, not very much, but there's a little bit of the differences existing from between these years now. And the key is, can we start to use that early season soil weather interaction information to come up with a better way of predicting what we need throughout the whole growing season. If you are in an area of the Midwest, like in Nebraska, where a lot of irrigation and you can direct apply nitrogen through your irrigation system, a fertigation type of approach. Maybe then you can push, you know, have multiple moments in the season that you can make that decision and get a better understanding. So part of this is getting the tool to help us to know what to do. Part of this is helping to develop the culture within the Midwest to help us to realize that the only way we're going to get to where we do a better job of in application is getting to adaptive approaches. It cannot rely upon, you know, preseason approaches. If we're going to do a better job at managing nitrogen on the corn acres here in the Midwest. So you have the soil variation, you have weather variation, the interaction of those two, and you get these kind of things that go on, and the spatial variation within fields. You got your management inputs, and all of these things together kind of are illustrated well in a nitrogen cycle type diagram. And the hope is that we can get the tools that help us to capture all of those things. And that's where the quandary is, because it's a lot of different moving parts, and we have to try to do the best job we can to consider all those moving parts. So I think that quandary is represented in this statement. Grower surveys often list nitrogen fertilizer management among the more challenging decisions of modern corn production. And it's because it's a moving target. It's not, if you're going to not close your eyes and just make a decision, but really try to do a better job, an optimized decision, you've got to take these things into consideration. And that's what makes it difficult. But what happens if we're not close to the right nitrogen rate, if we're off? Well, from the farmer's perspective, if he under applies, then he's leaving, you know, profit on the table. So he there's a tendency to push it to the upper end or even beyond the upper end. The problem with that is now we've got a counter push on that, and that counter push is the environmental. And so this is the first data slide I'll share with the group, and this is data from this project. So there's 49 sites. Of those 49 sites, each site has a economic optimal end rate that we were able to come up with. The x-axis on this, looks like my, there we go. Well, losing my pointer there for some reason, but anyway, so the x-axis is we're taking the end rate of an individual plot and subtracting the EONR, the economic optimum end rate, which is where we really would like to be at the end of the growing season. We calculate that. And it comes up with a difference. So you can see that at zero, that's when we're at the economic optimal end rate. And so what you see is that for the treatments that got less than economic optimal end rate, at the end of the growing season, we look at how much nitrogen is in the soil down to 3 feet that potentially is going to be lost over the coming winter. And we can see that it stays right at about 50 pounds of nitrogen per acre all the way until we get very close to EONR or the zero, and then it starts to climb. And it starts to climb fairly quickly. And from this data set, we can come up with a couple conclusions. One is that when applications are greater than about 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre over the EONR, then we start to see pretty close to that, just about a pound less in the soil for every extra pound that we leave there. So so fairly quickly, we're starting to get leave the field with a lot of nitrogen undercovered in the field at that point. I did some digging into the literature and some things that other people have done relative to modeling and evaluations and surveys and so forth, and come up with this, and it may be a little off, but it's a pretty good approximation, and that is about 20 to 40% of U.S. corn acres have nitrogen over application greater than 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year, per acre. So if you take that and you push that out, there are about 90 million U.S. corn acres per year, and if you take a mean of 60, and again, I dug this out, there's some that are even go up to quite a bit more than that, Use a mean of 60, you end up with about 405,000 tons of nitrogen annually that's available for loss at the end of the growing season. So this is the pushback on that economic. This is that environmental, and a lot of things are a lot of discussion is going on in the legislative halls and the regulatory halls relative to what do we do about this, because this is a big issue. That represents 585 barges of urea nitrogen per year that we're leaving out there in the field at the end of the year. And that's a lot of nitrogen. So moving on to this project. So we entered into some conversations back in 2013, I guess it was, when it really got started. About a collaborative project, and here are the names of those individuals from the other states that very quickly we realized there was an opportunity to meet multiple needs. Pioneer for a specific need of coming up with some data that they could use to validate and refine models that they were using, and for the public sector represented by these land grant institutions, and myself with USDA ARF, the tools that are out there in the public space. So this slide represents kind of what happened then. The data got put together. The data kind of goes and serves two different purposes. And I think that really basic fundamental understanding of the different attention that was being given to that data for different purposes helped to frame this project in a way that everybody felt like this could be done. And I think it's a real good model of private-public partnerships that could go forward in the future. There were five graduate students that received training and experience on this project. Two of them were in the room. We're going to give them a chance to talk a little bit about what they've done here in a few minutes. So 49 sites, how do you get 49 out of 8 times 2 times 3? It's because Missouri had a third site the last year, so we got to 49. You see in this particular figure the representation of the different soils. We have alpha sol, highly weathered soils. We have mollisols. We have entosol. A number of different soils represented. A temperature gradient is pretty obvious as you go north to south. A precipitation gradient that increases as you go to the southeast. This is exactly what we wanted. We wanted a wide range of soil weather scenarios to kind of look at corn nitrogen response. One of the things that, you can, these next couple of slides or these animations show this, there's the textural triangle, but not actually seen as you typically would see a textural triangle, but it's the same in that you've got a wide range of variation in clay, sand, silt content, a wide range of soil organic matter content, a wide range in total total nitrogen in the soil. So that's really what we were hoping for. So the project, I think one of its greatest values is the fact that we, from the day one, all the team came here to Johnston in January of 2014, and we sat down together I can't remember which building it was now. You guys got a lot of buildings around here. Anyway, we sat down and we gave ownership to all of those individuals you saw in that earlier slide, and we said, how do we go about doing this? We had a day-long discussion in terms of sites and treatments and methods for doing analysis and how frequent to do those analyses, and we built a standard protocol, a procedure that everybody bought into. There was some, obviously, compromise that had to be given here and there for that. So you have some nitrogen treatments at planting as well as in season, and those are listed there. We also had a whole bunch of measurements, soil, weather, and measurements that were done, again, in a standardized way. We even put some YouTube videos together. When you're using this canopy reflectance sensor, this is how we want you to do it. We want you to make sure you do it in this way and hold it at this height. And we kind of shared that between the group to make sure that we were all on the same page. I threw this in here, project outcomes. For plot research, this is big data. It's not big data the way some of the data scientists would think of big data, but 49 response environments, a rich data set of soil characterization. Went out to each of the sites before the season, and we did sampling to 4 feet and analyzed those for texture and organic matter and pH and bulk density, and got a lot of site-specific information that can help us when we want to start doing some modeling work. Yield, canopy sensor, nitrogen uptake, nitrogen use efficiency, 3,100. Soil nitrogen ammonium analyses, almost 20,000 of those. Daily weather records, 17,000. There's 6 graduate degrees. There were 5 students, but 1 student getting both master and PhD. That's why it goes to 6. The science contributions in the form of journal publications, there's currently, I think, well, we're about at 4 that are published or near published, and 4 or 5, and probably another 5 within the next 6 months. Something like that. So quite a bit of publication, research publication that will come out of this project. And then DuPont Pioneer able to extensively use the data for the nitrogen modeling calibration validation that they're interested in. So what was the correct nitrogen rate? And there was a lot of discussion with the group how to do this, but this economic optimal N rate that I referred to earlier is kind of a critical measurement. And so we take the points from the different sites, and this is taking a site in Missouri, a lush soil site, and it's looking at the quadratic plateau response function for, and the brown is where all the nitrogen was put on at planting or just before planting, and the green is at the V9 growth stage. And so you get it took 230 pounds of nitrogen per acre for the at planting, and you got about a 255 bushel per acre yield, and you lost about five or six bushels per acre by doing the split, but you did it with 183 pounds, so 30 pounds less, we lost 5 pounds. So this is just an example of that EONR kind of work that we have to kind of that gives us the standard to be able to evaluate tools. And you'll see how these numbers that come off these kind of graphs are used by the 2 graduate students here in a minute. Variation in EONR. So you'd like to think that these things are fixed, but they're not. So this graph is pretty cluttered, but what we have here on the x-axis is the EONR measurements for the sites. The first graph we're looking at is the EONR measurements for the nitrogen put on at planting. And you can see the states. And then each year we asked each investigator to select both a productive soil and a less productive soil. And facetiously, the Iowa and Illinois investigators said, well, we don't have unproductive soil, so what are we supposed to do? So anyway, they did the best job they could. But we have a range in productivity of the soils, and then we have the different color of green represents the 3 years of the project. And so you have 49 boxes here showing the range. And the thing that's important is to note that it goes all the way from 0 all the way up to 280. So a full range of economic optimal N rate. When you go to the split application, the one thing you notice immediately is things start to collapse more into the middle. And so you still have the full range of 0 to 280, but things start to get narrow. And you can see that in another way of representing that in a box and whisker plot. These are quartile plots on the whiskers in the box, two halves of the box. So you can see how the middle part of the box, and it shrinks inside. So 50% of the sites are in a much narrower range than they were at planting when you go to that side dress application or split application. And so with this, I'm going to turn it over to Curtis and let him tell you a little bit about his research.
Have that on, right? Perfect. Okay, one of my goals or objectives was to evaluate all the publicly available tools for making a nitrogen recommendation. And that was one of the main questions that these researchers had for this project. And so, as Newell introduced, that being able to come up with that perfect nitrogen rate is really important for that farmer. And there's been a lot of effort throughout the years to come up with a way for the farmer to determine how much nitrogen to put down. And historically, the yield goal has been used, but it's been moved away from. A lot of the land grant universities no longer recommend that method. Excuse me. So some of them that are currently available, there's empirical-based models such as MRTN, which is used a lot in the Midwest. There are the crop growth models, and Circa being one of them. There's a whole list there. And I only focus on the Maize-N. That's the only publicly available model that I knew of. But the list continues to grow. And then there's the proximal canopy sensing. These try to assess the biomass and color of the plant and make a recommendation almost on a per plant basis. And then there's the soil test, and there's a wide variety of soil tests out there. But the two main ones are you take a soil sample prior to planting, or that PPNT or pre-plant nitrogen test, or you take an in-season nitrogen test, and that's the PSNT or the late spring nitrogen test. Now, in order to evaluate, there's several ways you could evaluate these tools, but ideally you'd want a tool that matched UNR or had a positive and significant linear relationship with UNR. So on the graph I have here, on the x-axis, I have, just as an example, that generic yield goal, 1.2 multiplied by an expected yield. On the y-axis, we have the UNR. So these are UNR of all 49 sites. And ideally, we want those points to line up on that one-to-one graph. But yeah, as you can see with the yield goal, and one of the reasons that people have no longer, or a lot of the universities no longer recommend it, is that you have this negative relationship. So the more, the higher the amount of nitrogen it recommends, the less the UNR that we found on this site. Then you have some tools where there's no relationship. So MRTN is one that is used in the Midwest, and in general, the range of recommendations is pretty narrow. And so in order to capture those sites that had where their UNR was zero, it's pretty hard to do. So you don't get a really good relationship. But the tools that I wanted to see and show that were successful are those that had a positive and significant linear relationship. As you can see, the pre-citrus nitrogen test is able to capture some of those sites that had a low UNR, and so was able to get that good relationship. And so it's encouraging for farmers that they have a little bit of chance of predicting UNR at the time of using the tool. Now, when we look at, there's a wide range of tools available, and I just wanted to show you the breadth of the tools we have. So on the y-axis, you have the tool recommendation minus UNR. And so a tool, on average, if they're performing well, they would line up on that zero line. And the blue graph there are the tools that had a significant and linear relationship. And the yellow are those that either didn't have a significant relationship or were negatively related. And you can see that the tools, on average range from underestimating UNR, that canopy reflectance sensor, by about 40 pounds of nitrogen per acre, to overestimating all the way up to about 70 pounds of nitrogen per acre. So there's a wide range here, and a lot of these tools just didn't work very well. Even those that were significantly linearly related to UNR, they underestimated by quite a bit. So the farmer's not going to get a whole lot of return by using those tools. But just to point out, those that worked that did on average come close to UNR, those were the ones that were based on soil tests. So the pre-plant nitrogen test or some variation of that pre-citrus nitrogen test. However, another way of looking at and evaluating these tools is understanding that UNR is kind of a fuzzy number. We treat it as a gold standard, but there is some buffer in how we calculate it, how we fit the model. And so there's some room around that number. And so if we take a step back and say, well, if the tool recommended, 15 pounds away from UNR, that might still be considered as good. So I've cut out the percentage of sites that came close to UNR and classify them either as good, mediocre, or poor. So good being if if the tool recommended within 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre, that would be considered good. And then calculated the total amount of sites that came within that. You can see here that the MRTN is about 43% of the sites came within 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre. Now, if we back that out to what if the tools came within 60 pounds of nitrogen per acre, you know, that might still be okay, as UNR might vary as much as 60 pounds. And so, you can see there. And then bad is everything else. If it's above 60 pounds of nitrogen per acre, we might consider that as a poor performing tool. So ideally, we would want a tool that maximizes the amount of good sites and minimizes the amount of bad sites. So just in general, these are all tools used at planting, and you can see that, you know, they rank in terms of how good and how bad they are. You can see that MRTN, even though it wasn't significantly linearly related to UNR, it still had a high percentage of sites that were good due to the narrow range. And so it's able to capture, on average, a lot of those sites. And in general, you can see the yield goal approaches don't perform very well. And that maize and crop growth model is kind of on the bottom of the middle there. And then the pre-plant nitrogen tests are perform a little bit better. Now, when we look at tools that are used for a in-season application, a lot of these are the same, but there's a few more tools that a farmer can use, such as canopy reflection sensor or pre-side dress nitrogen test. And one thing to note, if we look at the planting and then look at the side dress again, the amount of green increases and the amount of bad decreases. So using a tool for at side dress, you have a little bit more information to play with and are able to make a little better estimate of what UNR would be using that tool. And if we look at just averaging across all the tools, the percentage of good would be about 25% for planting. And then if we looked at side dress, it jumped up to about 32%. So one take-home message is, you know, the using tools at side dress definitely perform better, but there's room for improvement. So some other work I wanted to do was try and improve these tools. There's a large data set, and so we have the opportunity to improve it. But there's a few ways to do it, and I just want to focus on one way. And that would be, if you had a tool that was, you know, had a, for instance, like this tube here, low horsepower, but it's pretty flexible, it's maneuverable. And if you combine it with a tool that has, you know, high horsepower, but isn't as flexible, could you somehow come up with a better tool, or James Bond car being the gold standard? Using this analogy, ideally we would want to take unique tools together and fuse them or combine them in some way. So I'm going to talk about two ways I've tried doing that. And one is just using a simple decision tree. So we took two or three tools and plugged it in through a decision tree. Could we come up with better recommendations? And ideally, we would. This is just for test of concept. I just took three unique tools and tried to combine them together. And ideally, with using the yield goal approach, it does have some benefit, especially on those higher end rates with this data set. And it does incorporate a lot of the farmer's knowledge, which is important. Then, if we add to that an assessment of the soil nitrogen, which performed pretty well on the lower nitrogen rates. Then if we add to that the canopy reflection sensing, which is an assessment of the plant, the nitrogen in the plant, we hopefully should be able to come up with a better tool. And so how the decision tree works is kind of just like a flow chart. And if we look at three tools, it splits the data up into homogeneous groups and comes up with the average of those groups. And so if we have the Iowa pre-sidress nitrogen test and it recommends less than 124 pounds of nitrogen per acre, we would then go down and use the canopy reflection sensor. Depending on what recommendation we have there, we would either come up with a new recommendation of 70 pounds or 129 pounds. And then on the other side, kind of a similar approach. If the Iowa pre-sidress nitrogen test was above 124 pounds, we would then use the yield goal approach. And I mean, these tools could be substituted and new tools could be evaluated. But how this looks is pretty similar graph. On the x-axis, you have this new tool. And on the y-axis, you have the UNR values. And you can see that there's five discrete nitrogen recommendations. However, that slope of the regression is indicated in that dashed blue line. And that line's right up on the one-to-one graph, a one-to-one line. And you see, there's those dash borders around the one-to-one line, and those indicate the borders around plus or minus 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre. So if we look at the R-squared, it jumps up to 0.37, whereas before, the most we could get is 0.24. So we do get some improvement, and the percentage of sites that come close to UNR goes up to about 45%. So another way of combining these tools is, I like to think of it as, you know, welding these tools together, mashing them together as best we can. And so using our regression approach, we can do something pretty similar. And I just want to show you some box and whisker plots. On the y-axis, you have, again, the difference between the tool and UNR. And these are just tools unadjusted, just to show you what they were like before combining or adding them together. And then when we use the regression and just use the main effects, or just two or three tools together, all of a sudden you get the box and whiskers that line up on that zero line. So the median there lines up, and the boxes themselves shrink down. The whiskers themselves don't shrink down that much, but at least you get some improvement. However, when we add the interactions, two or three tools together, plus all the interactions that we can, you can see on the furthest end of the graph there, it lines up on that zero line, and the box and whiskers decrease by quite a bit. And then compare that to the decision tree, that's just what it looks like. So if we look at the R-squared, regardless of what tools you combine together, whether you add two or three, you get an improvement in R-squared, the best being the last two bars you see there. And then how close they came to UNR, the main story is, again, if you add two or three tools together, you get some improvement to the percentage of good you have there, and you minimize the amount of bad you've got there. So in conclusion, to just a brief summary, again, if you use tools at side dress, they generally performed a little better than those used at planting. However, no tool really performed very well. The best performance we got was an R-squared of 0.24, and then the amount of the percentage of sites that came within 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre was 44%. However, when we try to combine them using this tool fusion approach, we were able to get an R-squared of 0.46, and then the percentage of sites that came within 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre jumped up to 55%. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Max, who's going to talk a little bit more about a different way of improving. All right. Perfect. Thank you. So before I begin my slides, I just want to say this was an awesome project to work on. So I came in as a master's student and didn't really know anything about graduate school and the project. So Newell was kind of like Curtis. Newell was going to put me on a bioenergy project. And boy, am I glad that I was put on this project instead of a bioenergy project. So I'm very grateful. I feel blessed to be a part of this. Got to travel around a lot of different sites and see cool soil, great people. So it's been fantastic. So Curtis talked about combining tools, right? He has his tuk-tuk and his semi-truck, and he gets the Aston Martin. I'm just focusing on one tool, and it's the Canopy Reflectance Center. This is a rapid scan. It's a model by Holland Scientific. And instead of combining it with some other tools, I'm going to try to make it better by, you know, if I follow Curtis's car analogy, it'd be like putting some mud terrain tires on it, or turbocharger or something like that to enhance it instead of combining it with another tool. So a little background on canopy sensors. How do they work? Well, they collect and compare light that's reflected from an enriched crop canopy to light reflected from an inefficient crop canopy. So here's just a quick picture depicting what you may see or what the canopy sensor may see. So if you have a healthy plant, we generally refer to this as an enriched plant. And it's going to absorb more blue and red light, reflect more green and near infrared light. And then if you have an inefficient corn plant, we call that the target corn, and that's going to reflect more blue and red light and absorb more green and near infrared light. And then coupled with an algorithm or a mathematical expression or equation, it takes that relationship between the enriched and the inefficient crop and comes up with the nitrogen fertilizer recommendation. And as you can see at the bottom, there's a lot of sensors and algorithms available out there. We just used one, and like I said, that was the rapid scan. And while for my research, I did look at multiple algorithms, today I'm just showing you results from the University of Missouri canopy sensor algorithm. So this is the graph that Newell showed you. This is talking about the in uptake and during the corn plant's life. And when you use canopy sensors to come up with some kind of nitrogen fertilizer recommendation, you're doing it in season, usually between V5, V6. And if you're in an irrigated system with a pivot, then maybe you can mount a canopy sensor on the pivot system and you can go later in the season and continually sense and maybe apply fertilizer multiple times throughout the growing season. We applied it at V9, and the whole purpose of using canopy sensor technology is to use the crop as a indicator or bioassay of what the plant has gone through up to that point in its life, and saying, okay, this is what the canopy sensor sees, so this is what we're going to have to apply to reach our economic optimal end rate. So one of my objectives for my research was to evaluate the performance using this canopy sensor and the University of Missouri algorithm. So how well did it predict or estimate EONR? So this graph, you're going to see a few of them. So let me just explain it kind of in depth up front, and then you guys will know when the next graphs come along what to get out of it. So on your x-axis, you have EONR. On your y-axis, you have the University of Missouri algorithm recommendation. And ideally, that recommendation from the algorithm would have matched EONR. And so all 49 site locations would have fallen on that one-to-one line dissecting the graph in half, which is very similar to what Curtis or Dr. Ransom has shown you earlier. The yellow shaded region, if sites fall within that shaded region, they're within 30 pounds plus or minus of EONR. And that's the percentage of those sites that are in the yellow shaded region are represented by the box in the top right corner. So for the Missouri algorithm, without any kind of adjustment, we had 29% of the sites fall within 30 pounds of EONR. And then that dashed line represents the slope of those sites. And so right now the slope is, I think, about 0.2, and we want it to be at 1. We want it to be right under that 1-to-1 line, suggesting that the canopy sensor algorithm did a good job at estimating EONR. And the different colors represent the different years of the study. So overall, you can see that the algorithm performed pretty poorly at estimating EONR. And so that brings up my other objective for my research. Can we use soil and weather information to come up with a more robust or a stronger algorithm that can help estimate EONR a little bit better? So this is a picture of a soil Giddings, and this was purchased by you guys for us to use and go around to all these 49 site locations and characterize the soil. And like I said, that was one of the coolest things for me as a grad student, is being on this team to go around and collect the soil measurements. We brought them back to one of the labs on the University of Missouri campus, the Soil Health Assessment Center. And we characterized those soils, or they did. This is just one of the tools that they used to come up with particle size analysis. And so I looked at that, so that's your percent sand, silt, and clay. Looked at plant available water, cation exchange capacity, organic matter, pH, and bulk density, right? And I looked at these for other research purposes, but what I'm presenting for you today, I'm just looking at basically percent clay, plant available water, and organic matter. For the weather information, we had weather data for all 49 sites. We had a HoboLink weather station at each of these locations. We collected growing degree days, total precipitation, solar radiation, the Shannon Diversity Index, which we used to come up with the evenness of rainfall from the time of planting to the time of canopy sensing. And so it's an index with a range of 0 to 1, 0 being all your rain came at once, and about an SDI value of 1 would mean that your rain was perfectly distributed throughout that period of time. And then if you multiply that index by total precipitation in that same period of time, you get something called abundant and well-distributed rainfall. And I looked at these four different variables for this objective. So you've seen this graph before, right? This is the Missouri algorithm without any soil and weather adjustment. When we take the algorithm recommendations and And when I came up with what soil variable to use, I took the difference between the algorithm recommendation and EONR, and then we regressed all the soil and weather information against those differences to decide what could explain those differences the most, right? So when we took the algorithm recommendation and the most significant weather variable and adjusted the algorithm recommendation with that variable, you can see the improvement here. And so if you pay attention to the cluster sites, they're pretty much, say, if you look at a clock, they're at like a 3 o'clock position. And then you go here and they turn and they're almost at a 1 o'clock position. So they're becoming more, or at least closer to that one-to-one line. And the cluster maybe even is some of these sites, especially if I go back that far right top corner, the Black Missouri site, when we start accounting for weather, it's in that, it's almost on the line, right? So when we account for the evenness of rainfall, we can account for some of the variation that we saw at that site. When we just look at when we just adjust the algorithm with soil information, again, we have that dashed line and the cluster of sites coming closer to that one-to-one line. We get more percentage of sites within 30 pounds of EONR. It jumped from 43% with just weather to 55% when we use just soil. And then if we look at adjusting the algorithm with soil and weather information, while the percentage of sites isn't as high, the slope of that dashed line is getting closer to the one-to-one line, suggesting as a whole, the algorithm is performing better when you include both soil and weather information. So this is just, you've seen box and whisker plot like this with the previous presenters. So you want, on your x-axis, I have the different algorithms and their adjustments, and on the y is the difference between the algorithm and EONR. And in an ideal world, there wouldn't have been any difference between the two, and so those box and whisker plots would be perfectly aligned on that zero line. And so you see as we adjust it with soil and weather, we get a lot better accuracy and precision, less range with our recommendations as well. So in summary, the MU algorithm was pretty marginal in predicting or estimating UNR. When you add in soil or weather information, it improves. The best performance is when you combine soil and weather information and then improve the or adjust the algorithm. But overall, there's still room for improvement. However, our idea was that there's strengths at different scales, and we want to take soil and weather information from all of this regional scale and then micro scale information collected from the sensor, almost plant by plant sensor information, then tie them together to come up with a better performing Canopy sensor algorithm. And for the most part, that's what we did. We came up with a better performing algorithm. So, and with that, I will turn the time over to Dr. Kitchen for one or two more slides.
So I have just a few slides to kind of summarize our outcomes of the project, which tool we used. Actually, let me pause and say that one of the things you'll hopefully have noticed is that the tools that we're looking at, by virtue of the fact that there's funding and energy put to the development of these tools at state level, oftentimes that's the environment that they're going to represent. You saw a bunch of those that Curtis had up there that said Minnesota or Iowa or whatever, you know, and it's not just the yield goal, it's the PFMT or whatever. And that kind of represents that fact that it's a kind of a local geography. It's not Corn Belt representation, it's state representation. So one of the outcomes I think you can take from this is that a lot of these tools developed kind of within states don't do a very good job when you use it against data that's collected over the whole Corn Belt region. They tend to fall apart. And that kind of makes sense because they were developed and calibrated for a smaller geographical region. When many of the currently public available and recommendation tools don't work well, it's usually when it's less than 100 pounds of infrared or over 200. Kind of in the middle, they were working generally a little bit better. Tools that use soil and crop measurements or that on the fields of interest within the season generally work better. and performance improves when tools are fused, as Curtis mentioned. Fields that historically show within-field greenness variation on wet years. All you have to do is go to Google Earth and look at some of those historical images. That's easy for people to do. Those deserve a tool that really addresses the spatial variation within fields. And if you go to those wet years and you don't see a lot of variation within fields, then maybe not. But there's a lot of good information that people, and most farmers, if they know their fields very well at all, they know that kind of things can be happening. But you can look at that type of imagery and see that. Tool development and validation are needed that are adaptive to the weather and soil interactions. That's where we need to continue to push research within the public as well as the private sector. Adaption is needed. And if this thing called climate change is for real, that adaption is going to even be more important for us to have as a part of nitrogen management. And then I threw this in here that, you know, a lot of farmers are just wondering, what can I do today? This is my tool. I'd like to really kind of get a better sense of how well it's performing. Well, there's a lot of farmers that are using these strip trials where they add 30 or minus 30 based from the tool that they're currently using. And I won't go into details of this, but I think that is a really good approach, and farmers need to be encouraged to do that type of thing on their field. So I think we're getting close to a time where we would like to have a little bit of a question answer, Paul. So I think I'm going to, so I ran through those last few points very quickly. So why don't you guys come up here in case there's specific questions that come to you guys. So,
well, thank you, Newell, Curtis, and Mac. And you can see that if those of us are agronomists, that there's few challenges that are more important but also more difficult than managing nitrogen. And farmers they're busy people. They've got a lot going on. They need to have things that are simple and relatively straightforward to use in large operations. Nitrogen management is not easily one of those, and so that's the challenge we face. But for all the reasons that we talked about, economics, environmental, profitability, sustainability, it's a very important problem. And one reason it's very important to Pioneer Agronomy and Agronomy Sciences is we've had a tremendous collaboration. So, any questions in the room here for Newell or the group to start with? A lot of people here in the room have worked and interacted quite a bit with Newell and the group and are pretty familiar with some of the efforts that we have underway.
So. Of course, yeah. So the Mac on your last data figure.
Brent, I'm gonna give you the mic because we've got people on the line.
Mac, in your last data figure, you showed that you still weren't able to quite fully twist that relationship back up to the one-to-one line. Some you were underestimating a bit on the high end and overestimating a bit on the low end. And you're trying to account for some of those, say, physical processes in nature that affect that. What kind of thing do you think that you weren't able to capture with those variables? What do you think you could have done to add another variable, or what variable was missing for your analysis?
So if I think back to, do you want me to repeat the question, or is that?
No, he had the right question.
So if I think back to my soil genesis class, I was always taught that water drives everything. A lot of soil processes depend on water. And so some of the stuff I've looked at now that maybe I can include and can go back and reanalyze some of this, at least use the same approach I did here, is hydraulic connectivity, so your KSAT value, or your depth to the water table, or USDA, Surgo has hydrologic groups that they classify soils in. They take into account percent clay and sand and some of those other variables. And so I think accounting for that, anything that has to deal with water, and we all know that nitrogen is mobile and moves with water, and so if we can account for something like that, we could see some more improvement.
Perfect, thanks. So to kind of follow up on that, where would both of you like to see, and you too, Newell, where would you like to see efforts in research going, both from a private and public standpoint? Where do you think the opportunities are that we can try to address here?
For me, I think, Dr. Kitchen's research group is big in precision agriculture, and they've got access to a lot of sensors and technology, and using an approach similar to Curtis, I'd like to see some of those other sensors kind of fused together, or some kind of platform that's used where we can maybe get soil or weather information faster and applied or implemented, and whether it's a model or some other approach to help come up with a recommendation. But there's a lot of technology out there, and kind of figuring out, fusing stuff together to figure out which is going to help us the most. There's a lot that needs to be done there.
I think to add to that modeling, I'm encouraged by that, and I think if we can get it, we can use a EC map as an input or something that we can get a little higher resolution on the model within a field. We can capture that variability or somehow merge it with the canopy sensor. I think would be really interesting.
The thing that I think I see moving and you see moving very rapidly is the on-farm diagnostic tools, and especially UAVs and DPI is cheap. And a lot of some of the people we work with are getting them, and they're going out there and they're taking images and they're getting them stitched and they're looking at those things because they can do that really quite inexpensively. So whether it's satellite or a UAV kind of an approach of getting images of fields, and that's done quickly. Once you get under your belt about 3 or 4 flights, it's so easy now. And so I just think the future is going to be, we're going to just see a whole lot more of that. And we just need to develop the agronomic science associated with that imagery type of work and the decisions of what you would do with that nitrogen. So, there's probably some of what we're getting here relative to canopy reflective sensors that could be tied back to that. The different sensors that you can get on those UAVs are just going up, and prices are coming down. It doesn't seem like, it would seem as though that's going to bust open here real quick. And I'm sure many of you in the room are quite in touch, and out there in the webinar world here are quite in touch with the fact that that's happening. So
we got some questions on the line, so and Lance is going to communicate those.
First question from the line is from John Smith, who says, say hi to Newell.
Hi, John.
The question's for Matt. And John is asking, was the tool evaluated after the season, or was it used in a predictive way and checked after the season?
So, excuse me, the good question. The rapid scan will actually give you at least the research version of the rapid scan will give you an end rate recommendation as you're going through and scanning your research plots, but we did not use its predictive recommendation. So we waited until after the season and ran through, cleaned up our reflectance data, and then used it with these algorithms to come up with what it would have suggested for that field or research site. Hopefully that answers the question.
Thank you. One more that came in here. This one's from Tony Zerusen, and he asked, how well does maize N account for soil weather variation, and are we using this data to test Encirca, and how does it perform?
I can't answer the Encirca. I assume it's highly used here at Pioneer. But the maize N, it does account for the weather variation. We used up to 35 years or 30 years of previous weather, and that's, I assume, is used as a forecast for the future season after the time of recommendation, but it does have inputs for soil. Some of them are pretty generic, so there could be some improvements with the maize N, but yeah, it does take account of variation of soil and weather.
Okay. All right, thank you. And I'll just mention, as far as the Encirca here, there's several people in the room that worked on that, but this data, there was a lot of internal work, obviously proprietary, that went on that was somewhat similar to what you showed here to validate and improve our models as well. Okay, we have one here.
Sorry, we
take a couple more questions.
Sure. So maybe question for both Matt and Curtis. For those, I'm curious, for those locations that are far away from the one-to-one line, have you ever looked back and is there any aha moment saying, oh, we could have done better if we know this?
I mean, there's still some of that research going on, trying to dive into that. There are a few of those sites, and we include all 49 sites, and I think there's could be some justification for throwing some of those sites out. But yeah, there's, well, so the sites that had a lot, a high UNR, definitely had some noticeable weather issues, you know, either ponding or just high intensive rainfall. So what Matt did by adjusting for that, that seemed to help. But the sites that had low UNR, there are a few of those that are hard to explain. Might need a little more diving into.
I will also end with this comment. Again, we're testing these tools when the corn is this high. So we got at best a third of the growing season. And we're saying we're going to be able to predict how much corn, how much nitrogen this crop needs when it's only this high, all the way through to the, you know, physiological maturity. And so we're taking a third of the season and hoping to be able to get what you need throughout the whole season. So it's a little unrealistic to think that we're going to get, you know, 95% of the sites within 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre, you know, using the one metric there. We just can't do that. So we put a high bar up for ourselves by comparing it to EONR. And one of the things we need to do is make sure that we do that, but also maybe look at what's the status quo, what's currently the farmer doing, and saying, could, if we use this tool, could we see a 15% improvement over that? So there's two ways of looking at it. Most of what we've done today is looked at that high bar. And in a way, I don't want to create a message that we have tools that fail here when the tools just can't capture that two-thirds of the growing season that's yet to happen. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
No, I have one other question. By the way, great presentation, all three of you. Thank you. My question is a little bit outside the scope of your research, but you mentioned every year, what was it, 400,000 tons of urea is applied in excess on U.S. farmlands. Given the concern, environmental concerns with nitrogen runoff, that doesn't seem feasible to continue that direction in the future. Do you foresee any government regulations coming down the road to somehow restrict either the amount or the types of application methods? That's number one. And number two, do you see the fertilizer industry responding to any other types of slow-release fertilizers or any other ways to address that?
Two great questions. So regulation, is it going to happen here? Well, in Europe, a lot of European countries already have put on set amounts. You know, if you have this many hectares or acres, this is what you get. You distribute it. And then there's a bunch of other little things. You can't put it next to water. You can't do this. You can't do that. And so they've tightened it up pretty well over in some of the European countries. We've seen hints of that type of thing coming our way by virtue of the lawsuit that happened here in Iowa, by virtue of the rule that is under consideration and public review right now up in Minnesota. And in that case, it's not restricting amount, but it's restricting time. And so when you can apply in certain areas. And so it's probably a safe statement to say that as time goes on and as we become more environmentally sensitive or as a public, as a society, we're likely going to have pressure to do more. Whether it's going to get all the way to that regulation or not, I don't know in this country, but there's a lot of kickback, but there's certainly the pressure there from certain sectors of our society to say that we should be doing that. Yeah, fertilizer companies are doing that. The Agrium, others in the state of Missouri, almost all of the urea that's marketed, a lot of the urea that's marketed through one of the big co-ops in the state there, it's Super U. It's not urea anymore. And so there's a lot of changing of making certain sources available, whether or not farmers are going to want to, you know, pay the extra premium over time or not, we'll see. But there's a lot of work that has come from the industry. I think there's going to be more. We've had a meeting with a bunch of them down here in the city yesterday, and it was full of people from the fertilizer industry, and they're talking about the need to continue to move that direction.
Well, I think we'll wrap up here. There's a couple market themes that we have with Corteva that really relate to this work. I'll remind you of partner with society. And that's certainly an issue that we need to do with this situation, not only growers, but the societal issues. And then secondly, bring the outside in. And that's one of the things we've done with this project and with these seminars. And we work so much, we don't even hardly feel like Newell's Group is the outside. But outside of our organization, we really thank you much for the collaboration, for the presentation. And we'll wrap up here. Just give them a round of applause and thank you.